and welcome to the M&A Zing, the show for acquisition entrepreneurs, search funders and holdco builders across the UK, Europe and beyond. And beyond indeed this week, as our interview with an emerging searcher ventures into relatively new territory for the search fund model, the United Arab Emirates. Very excited to be getting into this discussion in a moment with my guest. But before we do, we have a quick update on a couple of items from this week's news in the world of search funds. Firstly, in the UK, we've been delighted to see the launch of Frontier Development Capital's Regional SME Debt Fund, which is a little bit different in so much as it's a division of Mercer Asset Management, an 80 million fund backed by West Midlands Pension Fund and the British Business Bank, each having committed 40 million with the intention to serve a number of applications, but including which SMB succession M&A in the regions, particularly in the lower quantum deal ranges, which we know are pretty hard to get finance for these days. So delighted to see that and more info in the show notes. And at the other end of the spectrum, on the equity funding side in Europe, we have Ithaca Capital Partners declaring that they've already returned 40% of their fund within the first year of the holding period, year four after 3 years of allocation. So congratulations to Michelle Welters, Frank Gomez-Landero and all of the Ithaca team.
So our guest today is Adam Gian-Siracusa, a founder of Oryx Legacy, one of the very first search funds focusing on acquiring SMEs in the UAE. Adam brings experience from top consulting firms like BCG, where he worked extensively in Dubai, focusing on strategy and economic development, as well as working for a large investment house for 5 years. He's now leveraging all of the insight that he gained during that journey to build Oryx Legacy. It is an absolutely fascinating story about spotting opportunities in a rapidly evolving emerging market. Adam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Gareth. Looking forward to it.
Lovely to hear about a bit about your backstory for the listeners and viewers and what brought you here, but particularly what was the catalyst that made you leap from consulting to becoming a searcher? What made you want to operate and acquire an SME?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. After finishing undergrad in the US, I joined what was Monitor and then became Monitor Deloitte. Was a consultant for about 4 years there. Towards the end of that, like most consultants, started to think through business school and was applying to business school. And first learned of the concept of a search fund while going through that application process. Thought it seemed like a cool idea. I always knew I struggled with zero to one, but I enjoyed the idea of going from one to 100. It just felt meatier to me. It felt like something that fit more my skill set. While in business school, more or less confirmed the tech and that angle really wasn't for me. But I also realized I wanted to be back in the Middle East. So I'd grown up in the Middle East, and frankly, I just enjoy the challenge of being in the Middle East or in other emerging markets. And so I came back to the Middle East post HBS with BCG, was there for a year and a half. I think there at the time, while I was familiar with the search fund concept, it was still tricky in an emerging market. There weren't a lot of funders that would look at search in the UAE. It was, so the time wasn't quite right. I was thinking at one point of going self-funded instead, but that creates, I think, in a market like the Middle East, other complications that I'm happy to get into. And so ended up joining a family owned investment firm called Safanad, which is a, you know, they do private equity and real estate primarily in Western markets, but also the Middle East. And so was there for about 5 years. And that also, I think, proved to be a very good education, not just on the investing side, but also the operations of investing. So my role there was as chief of staff to the CEO of the family owner of the firm. So I was working very closely with him on how do you think about running a investments firm. And I think the way he liked to put it was he wants his firm to be an investing firm where investing is the product. And it meant taking a much more active, involved operational role in both the portfolio companies and the day-to-day management. So I think that just seeing that, not purely from the investing side, but from the operations side, and pairing that with a strategy consulting toolkit ended up being what hopefully was the right formula.
Yeah, it sounds like a great way to cut your teeth if you're involved in an institution, an investing institution where they take an operational involvement in their portfolio company somehow. Could you speak a little bit to some of the experiences you had rolling your sleeves up and going beyond the investing and in the operational side?
Yeah, sure. So I was more involved in the operations of the firm itself. So involved, everything from, it would vary on a daily basis, but at times we'd be involved in setting what should be the firm's multi-year strategy, which would involve getting into both what pockets do we see, what's the growth plan, how does that link to the financial aspect of how we see that performing. So that was one side, and I'd call that strategy in biz dev. Also got involved a lot in how we manage our board, how we engage with our board, which I think is always useful in any institutional environment. Heavily involved in a lot of hiring, so both at the very senior and sometimes at the junior level, which again useful in any context, but I think depends on the type of company. But then also just day-to-day operations for a organization that spans a few countries. So we had the CEO of the group runs a few different businesses. It's he comes from a multi-business family, and just he's a fantastic guy, but he's also very heavily stretched. So that created space for me to, in essence, get involved in making decisions, pushing different agendas or different areas of focus within the company, just and serving kind of as his representative to get stuff done, which. And the area of that would vary on any given. I think sometimes it'd be how do we restructure our investment ops piece, or some of the strategy work. How do we bring a portfolio company in the U.S. to the Middle East? It would the call it project would vary on a weekly basis, daily or even weekly basis.
Sure. Yes. Sounds like an interesting way to get exposure to different parts
Yeah.
of a complex business or a complex group of businesses. So let's just roll back slightly. So you left BCG. You were at that time interested in search, but found the ecosystem in the GCC a little immature. And so spent 5 years at Safanad. You mentioned that you at one point thought about going the self-funded route, which brings its own challenges. Would you want to unpack that for us?
Yeah, sure. So I think this links to the so self-funded works very well in a lot of Western markets, I think. I think in the Middle East, where the UAE specifically, we're a very new market for search. And one of the biggest challenges in this market is access to credit. And so knowing those two things, if you go a layer down in a market where people haven't heard of search, and in a market list, when you approach someone to try to buy a business when they're not used to selling, one of the first things they'll want to see is, show me a bank account with the full amount of this transaction sitting in it. They'll still just start with that point, and then they'll say, great, all right, let's continue the conversation. Now, that's great if you're a very liquid family office or individual that actually has, the $5, $10 million sitting in a bank account, but frankly, most people do not. And as well, credit is very tough in this market, and that means if you're going to, it's just hard to obtain. And it's even harder if you're a self-funded individual with no money in the bank. People just aren't going to take you seriously. And the if you look at this market, there, especially in the UAE, where there are a lot of people moving here, there are a lot of people, I'd say desktop shopping around for businesses. A lot of owners are uncomfortable with someone showing up saying, oh, I'm going to borrow it, and oh, I don't have the money right now. They're not going to take you seriously. So I think the one big part of it is if you want to be taken seriously, you don't need to have the money in your account in a fund, in a pure fund structure, but the closest solve I could get for that was saying, I've got a list of backers that, anyone here can diligence very quickly. They can find their websites, they can find some of the deals they've done. And that helps. Let's call it the cleanest solve for credibility that I've been able to find. So it also helps then with approaching banks and saying, look, I do have institutional backers behind me. No, we're not going to sign a personal guarantee, but at least I do have a group of investors behind me that merits this conversation getting a bit more credibility than kind of someone just shopping around. So I think that's one of the big angles here.
Yeah, sure. And actually quite a chastening process, I should imagine, finding that the leverage that normally drives a lot of the returns in search maybe isn't as readily available as it would be in Western markets.
Now you, so the problem, thing with the UAE is the UAE does have government support programs that are in fact probably even more generous than in Western markets, but those are only available, generally speaking, to local nationals. And Emiratis are give or take 10% of the country. Most there are the number of big Emirati groups, but most of the business community here is expat dominated. And as an expat, we don't have access to those programs, at least on the surface. And so access to, and the banks here unfortunately are well known for not lending to SMEs. So you know, in any transaction, you can try with the banks and try to get senior. It's a heavy lift. Or you're getting mezz from a non-bank lender, which is, as in most other markets, can be rather expensive.
And a little risky in
Yes.
some scenarios.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So absent the proof of funds test then, when you're rocking up to these SMBs and they're immediately saying, what we find brokers in the UK say a lot, show me the money. Are you finding they're reassured by the story of your journey?
So I think that helps. I have one thing really working in my favor. So on the one hand, yes, the being able to say, look, I've got an investor list. Here's the full investor list. You can look up all these people. I think that is, on one side, that helps. I think one huge difference in the UAE from other Western markets is that there's no one else doing it here. And oh, there's one other search fund active, Edmund Hosseini at Gulf Succession, who's a great guy, and we're friends, and we talk a lot. But there's two of us in this market, and beyond that, there aren't very many people. There, in fact, very few people that would even look at SMBs in that kind of traditional search fund size. So for a lot of owners, if you own a business, you know, in reality, your options are pretty limited, and this is probably one of the few conversations where someone has actually come up to you and say, hey, I'd like to buy your business. So it's or at least invest in it. And I think people, when someone's coming up to you saying, hey, I want to give you money, when it hasn't happened before, or it happens very rarely, I think people are just a bit more receptive, at least for that opening conversation. Whether it goes anywhere, totally different, totally different point. But I think they're at least more willing to have the conversation.
That's really quite enlightening to think that you're at the kind of crest of a wave. I mean, when you think about Dubai, I mean, I've been going back and forth to UAE, Ras Al Khaimah down to Abu Dhabi for 20 years, and it's changed significantly just in those 2 decades. I would perhaps have been under the impression that generational SMEs weren't as abundant as they are in other markets, in more established Western markets, because the sort of commercialization of the region hasn't is younger, if you like, hasn't got as much legacy to it. But that's probably an absolute mistruth on my part, or a misunderstanding on my part, having not lifted the veil and looked at whether there are companies that have got 40, 50 years of heritage that are now looking to sell.
So I think the pitch when you're approaching SMB in the UAE, it is slightly different. You don't have very many businesses with 40 years of heritage, to be honest. That's a bit of a stretch. And you're right, that is a bit of difference. 20 years, yeah, you've got plenty. I think one big difference here versus Europe is it's while there are some retirees, for example, the silver wave of retirees wanting to sell, in reality, like that is part of the narrative, but the other part that's very big in the Middle East is because it's so expat dominated, a lot of folks, when their kids hit university age, they might want to move back home to be closer to the family, especially if they've done well, they've built the business, it's successful. If you're looking at a $15 million payday, you've done well, your kids are in university, you can go live very comfortably in Spain, Italy, Jordan, wherever. And so that expat going home theme is actually also quite a common reason for wanting to sell. In fact, more so than retirees. The other common reason I'm finding so far is a lot of owners that, because of the way this economy is built up, a lot of people have their hands in, you know, 5, 10, 15 different pockets. And quite often they just want to simplify their lives. They'll say, you know, X, Y, or Z business I own is a perfectly good business. I just don't have the time to give it the right attention that it needs. And therefore they'll say, look, let me sell it. I can reinvest the cash in the businesses that I'm really excited about and someone else can grow this. So I think those two added themes are quite common here.
Amazing that maybe they fall down the list of priorities for kind of motivating sellers in Europe, but for them to be at the top of the list in the UAE, it says a lot about the way that the ecosystem there, the economy has evolved. But to be wanting to focus your portfolio and or like repatriate back to your, you know, country of your birth or whatever, those perhaps hadn't crossed my radar as being compelling events, but that's great. What a wonderful opportunity. And if we are now into this sort of like first generation change of ownership, if you like, from the founder progenitor to the new owners, and you want to give these liquidity opportunities to those original founders of that vintage of businesses, I'm surprised there's only you and Edmund Husseini that are doing this.
Yeah, it's so there's one or two private equity firms that are in that space. They're, you know, but yeah, otherwise it's very limited. It's just limited. And it's and that's why, I mean, to be honest, a lot of owners here haven't even thought about selling. Now, I do think that same trend that in the West of when people start really approaching retirement age, will they reconsider? Will the way pick up pace? I do think so. I mean, at the end of the, you know, I think it could certainly be larger. One thing to keep in mind when talking about the UAE is, you know, how big is this market in general? Mm-hmm. And the answer is it's not that big of a market. It's the way I actually looked it up in advance just to confirm, because I say it all the time, but I need to confirm it, is the UAE is basically the Greater London area. It's in terms of size, they're both about 10 to 12 million people. They're both give or take $600 billion, $700 billion economies. So in terms of, and they both take about an hour and a half, 2 hours to drive across. So the way I think about it is that's kind of what you're dealing with. But that also means at the SME size, it's not very deep. So you do have to look across sectors, but you have to bet that in each sector that fit that traditional search fund size, there are maybe four or five businesses per sector or per traditional area. After that, otherwise they're too big or they're too small. And I think that phenomenon repeats itself quite often. So it's a tricky market in that way as well.
Quite a concentrated Goldilocks zone then in regards finding the perfect business in the vertical of choice or sector of choice. So clearly you must have had a first mover advantage then. How has that played out? And maybe it would be a good opportunity to also tell us a bit about Oryx Legacy's thesis specifically, and then how this first mover advantage has been advantageous there.
Yeah, sure. So we launched just a month ago formally. I mean, I've been informally raising the money and then speaking to advisors, brokers for the past year, but formally launched actually literally a month to the day. So it's been very, very recent. Reception so far has been very positive. I mean, I just got back from two meetings today. I think I've got multiple deals in the pipeline that I think are interesting, and you know that I need to now spend some time running numbers through to actually take the investor base and kick around. But you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity here. But they're not in one sector. They do span multiple sectors, and it's kind of one or two per sector. The thesis is, so it's a UAE focused thesis, and in part that links to, I think, the macroeconomic trend that you see, which is the UAE in general is one of the most rapidly growing markets on the planet today. You know, we're not growing at 10% akin to some true emerging markets, but the market here is growing at a steady 4 to 5%, which for a market with the per capita income of the UAE is quite rare. And you do feel it when you're here. It's, you know, there are cranes operating quite literally everywhere. I mean, I saw a stat the other day that there were 1,000 people moving to Dubai every day on average this year, which is the equivalent to, you know, about 8% of the city growing at 8% a year.
I was going to say, I think is Greater London. That's
Yeah.
been moving over for reasons of our own creation with our chancellor taxing us to the hilt.
Exactly. And I will say it's, which I think speaks to the second point about the UAE, which is the UAE, part of the story with the UAE is that we are quite often the net beneficiary when there is instability elsewhere in the world. So the, you know, the when markets are calm, the UAE sometimes slows down. But since 2020, you've had COVID, and the UAE responded very effectively, which pulled in a lot of people. You had the Beirut port explosion, which attracted a huge share of Lebanon's it's called skilled diaspora that was living there. I mean, the most well-known is the Russia-Ukraine conflict, which drew in, I mean, hundreds of thousands of Russians and Ukrainians to the country. And nowadays, exactly, it's there's been a massive influx of individuals out of the UK, and it's, I mean, it's, and you see it in the press, everything from your multi-billion dollar family office that's leaving London and redomiciling in Abu Dhabi and in Monaco or something, to even your, you know, your individuals that are have, you know, 5 to 20 million dollars or pounds. You have that whole range is moving here, and each of those, you know, they're each of those movements are a function not of what's happened in the UAE necessarily, but what's happening in the host country. But the UAE, because it's easier to, because they've simplified visa processes. So if you need permanent residency, it can take years in a Western country to get. It takes a week here, literally 1 week and you're done. You know, policy simplification that's made it easy to operate here has been a huge net positive for entrepreneurs, wealthy individuals, business people being willing to move here. And so the Oryx thesis is A, tapping into that macro trend, that this is a place that's growing, and the ingredients underpinning that openness to the world, that flexibility are enduring, because that's the genesis of why of what the country's always done. So I like the macro thesis, and then you go micro on a sector by sector basis. And here, I think there the thesis is to target opportunities that tap into that kind of ongoing population growth, ongoing demand growth in this market. So nothing terribly complicated. It's, you know, there is a need for education, there's a need for healthcare, there's, you know, this market is very tourism dependent. As more businesses move here, they need business services, business support. Families need home services to take care of their houses. So yeah, nothing complicated. And the reason for it not being too complicated is, I think it's what I was saying earlier, is there's not much depth in this market in terms of on a sector by sector basis. So if I went and said, great, I want to be solely focused on education, I've got five or so targets that are at that size that fit. But if any of them don't want to sell, or we couldn't agree on valuation, or I just can't get in touch with the individual that's important, that sector's done and it's on to the next thing. And so, you know, that's the, I think that's the, but that is the challenge of the thesis as well. And that's the reason you need to be sector agnostic. I think the last part of the thesis I would say is a regional thesis. So the UAE is an incredible hub market, and it's attracting a lot of people. It's growing quite well, but it is also a part of, it's London. And it is part, though, of a larger market that is the equivalent of Italy. So I mean, Saudi Arabia, Oman, Qatar, Bahrain, and Kuwait are all very close by and very tightly integrated with the UAE. And so any business that's in the UAE in general, I mean, you're almost always looking at, one of the first things you do is you turn around if you're stable and you say, great, how do I expand to each of those markets? And they're all very different markets. I think it's often underappreciated how different they are. But you would always certainly look at each of those markets and say, all right, from a, because they're similar, there are certain similarities, which ones make sense to expand into? And at that point, that's a big market.
So, with regard to those markets geographically, but also those segments and sectors that you spoke to earlier, regards to healthcare and education and B2B services, are those areas that you had good exposure to or opportunity to research and get involved with at Safanad?
Education and healthcare, yes. Safanad's actually Safanad and the family that own it are own a 60,000 student global education operator. and they own a 6,000 student school in Riyadh. So they're big, very big in education. Healthcare, Safanad's actually the owner of the largest care homes company in the UK. So, that also aware a bit of some of the dynamics around the health, and we own, and the firm owns a healthcare asset in Saudi Arabia. So I've seen a bit around both sectors, both globally and regionally through the firm. Pet services, no, but pet services is funnily enough, which is mostly vets, is one of those sectors that is very much a UAE only sector in the region. A lot you education healthcare you can take to Saudi, Qatar, Oman, Bahrain, etc. Pets, vets, tricky, but that's because the UAE is Gulf Arabs and in general people, a lot of Muslims don't like having dogs, and dogs are most of the margin in vets. So you're charting expats, and there's in the UAE. So the UAE is of the entire Middle East, North Africa region. The UAE is literally half the vet market, and it's, call it less than 10% of the population of that region. So vets are UAE only. Business services, again, depending on the sector, would take it regional in a heartbeat. Tourism, there's a massive focus on tourism in the GCC these days, but I didn't do much of that in Safnad.
Cool, great. Well, so a bit of unexplored territory and a bit of familiar stamping ground. Nice.
Exactly.
Tell us a bit about the process of raising capital then. You spoke earlier about the challenges of raising debt finance, commercial finance, credit, but let's speak to the equity piece. Like you mentioned that you had spent a year working with investors, closing the search phase. How's that gone?
So quite smooth, all in all. So the virtue, but what really helped me is Safanad and or one of the partners in Safanad. When I first told them I wanted to do this, they turned to me and they said, "Look, we like you. We want to help you. This is not our strategy, though. So we will, on a personal basis, anchor your fund. Now go raise the rest. We can't manage it, but we can certainly help. And we know the region. We've got access here, so we're happy to help." So I started with Safanad committing up to 30% of the fund. In reality, I only needed 10 because I have a bunch of other investors. But what that did is it meant that I could go, when I was raising the rest of the money from global investors, I could say, "Look, I've got a," and in fact, the individual, the partner who anchored it was, a very senior, he was the number two at one of the at Mubadala Capital at one point, which is a massive sovereign wealth fund in the UAE. So I could go and say, "Look, I've got someone that I've got an organization that knows the region that's anchoring this." The first thing any global investor is going to ask when they're looking at a new market is, "Who's your local investor?" And for me, because that was ready on day one, it was a, call it, smoother conversation. That being said, it wasn't necessarily easy, and part of it is I think a lot of your traditional search investors are, if they're in funds, and the fund investors tend to be the bigger ones, are geographically restricted.
Yeah, must be
So
tricky for US investors to invest in GCC vehicles like this, given their
it's so
accounting obligations and, domestic
it
tax
funny
rules.
it, it wasn't it's funny, it wasn't too big from a legal standpoint. It wasn't an issue for them. It was more, it's and I get it, to be fair. If you're an American investor, you've got a just colossal home market. It's you need a good and a home market that's performing extremely well from a return standpoint.
Well, it
Why?
isn't growing 4 to 5% a year on the GDP level, though.
No, true. But from search, a lot of search investors do very well in their home market. So, it's I found in American institutional investors were virtually a no-go. The so a few, but then I think there are, I think what is changed is there are a few investors, institutional investors, that are looking at new markets. So, and by this I mean, Ambit Partners, Saravo, and Spectra are all on my cap table. I think they
Great.
all, they're all looking at new markets and trying to diversify as well. I mean, Ambit's whole strategy is pretty much we're going to look at those at the markets that everyone else ignores, which is great. I mean, I think it's a fantastic approach. But all three have been great partners. But then I think a lot of the fundraising came from family offices who don't have those geographic restrictions that the fund investors tend to have. And I think for a lot of family offices, their attitude is, "Look, I'm very exposed to my home market in various ways. The UAE is a for all the reasons mentioned earlier, is an attractive market. Why don't I see if this could work? This could be very interesting. I think for a lot of the European ones as well, a lot are probably overexposed to their home European countries. So for them, it was an added layer of interest.
So with the original anchoring that you didn't end up needing all of from Safanad Madabla partner, what did that translate to at the end in terms of the composition of your cap table, percentage-wise in terms of local money, like GCC investors versus international investors?
It's about 2/3 international, 1/3 local.
Nice. So you happy with that mix?
Very happy. Because I think each bring something very different to the table. And that's frankly the best part, is the GCC investors bring deep local knowledge. They understand how to do things in this market. They understand, you know, what it takes to get a deal done here, and they know what to look out for. The global investors bring more capital, but pattern recognition, a understanding of the search model, and that rigor as well. So they complement each other very nicely. And that part's been very, very helpful, and I'm very happy with. At the end of the day, I mean, you always know that in any search fund, not everyone's going to sign up for the deal itself, and there's always going to be a bit of an equity gap, and I am prepared for that. My guess is, like most things, it is a new market. Not everyone will get comfortable with it. So I suspect lose a few of the international investors when a deal comes along, but I'm pretty comfortable I can fill that with regional investors if any do decide they're going to pass.
Great. Really admire that confidence. And it sounds like you're well insulated there one way or another. Do you have any pearls of wisdom, any advice for any emerging searchers on the capital fundraising
activity? Yeah, it's a challenge. And I would say definitely, you know, brace for it. But I think one thing is, there's always, if you're fundraising, there's always a bit of a chicken and the egg problem around this question of a local anchor or a local investor, in that you need one, but does it make sense to start with a global or a local? It goes either way. I think in general, it makes sense to start with to get your local investor in first. Everyone's going to ask for it. But if you have someone locally who can talk through the strengths of the market, you know, is comfortable operating here, knows how things are done, I think get them in early. It will help a lot. I think two is know your, you know, spend, if you're in a new market, spend some time, make sure you've spent some time in that market quite extensively. So, you know, I think in the West, it's quite common where, you know, you can run a Pan-American US search, for example, straight out of business school. I think if you're in a new emerging market that no one's touched before, that it might be harder to do it straight out of business school. You know, the bar on having a local network, local context, et cetera, is just a bit higher, because I think investors want to de-risk it a little bit. And so the deeper your local network can be, et cetera, I think that only helps. I think those two things I would focus on. Lastly, I'd say go wide. You know, it's once you've got a local investor, don't be afraid to ping quite literally everybody. I mean, I can't remember how many emails I shot out to, some cold, some warm, to every investor, both US and global, US, European primarily, just to see who was interested. You know, at worst, they're going to say no. So, you know, what's the worst that can happen? Even when people pass, some have said, look, we can't do UAE for fund reasons, but we're very happy to stay as an advisor, a thought partner. And so I've taken them up on that as well.
Get them on fund two.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Once you've proven the, because you've got the job of educating everybody. And I guess that raises the question that in your PPM, did you depart much from the sort of Stanford template, if you will, and have to, you know, put a lot of effort into educating as to the space and the geography?
So I did two things. I mean, so I had the PPM that was exactly that, basically a copy of the standard Stanford PPM. I also did and I think this is because of my consulting background, I had a presentation as well that I think is just a bit more digestible. I find a 40-page text block to be difficult to read through and a bit painful.
Not something that necessarily engages your audience.
Yeah, exactly. So I also had a presentation that was, 30 pages or so, but more graph driven, that literally just talked through the macro context for the market. And I think that actually helped. I don't think I ever actually presented the document per se, but I sent it around to everyone. I think most people preferred reading that. And then most investors looked at the PPM as well, because there were a few things that were not in the wider presentation that were called keynotes, certain nuggets in the PPM that they reviewed, but that was later in the process.
Got it. So you closed the search phase, capital raise, and now you're into the actual sourcing. Could you speak to a little bit that what methods you're using? You mentioned about advisors and broker meetings earlier, but what other tools are available to emerging searchers in the GCC to find businesses?
So that's a very good question. In general search, you've got the two approaches, the intermediated and the proprietary. And I think on the intermediated, the challenge with, and this is, I think, one of the big challenges in the GCC, is that ecosystem is not very developed and it's not very large. In the US or Europe, you have, a very deep, very robust broker network. You've got SMB advisors, SMB lawyers, accountants, kind of you name it. You have that ecosystem is there and it's robust and it's deep. No, I think there are three brokers in the UAE, broker firms, with, two are primarily a website, but have a couple people on site. One has individuals there, but that's it on a broker standpoint. On the
For all the
SMB
Emirates?
and for all the Emirates, yeah, for the whole country,
Goodness.
there's for SME advisors, call your M&A advisors. There are, account 8 to 10, maybe give or take, but even that might be a bit of a stretch. And you can tell you've started to run through the ecosystem when different people are proposing to introduce you to people you've already met. So at that point, okay, I've got a pretty good handle on who's actually in this market. And so the advisor ecosystem is there. It's not that deep. But what it means is you can get to know pretty much everybody. And it's because you have all the big names here. Like you have the big four accounting firms, you have a lot of the banks, et cetera. But all of them are very busy working for the very active sovereign wealth funds. And they won't take on any, they won't do any deal that isn't going to earn them, give or take, $1 million in fees. And that's obviously out of the remit of a search fund. So while it will look like there's an active advisor ecosystem, there is, but only for larger deals, not for SMB deals. So either way, the result is I've spent the first month and also pre-launching getting in front of all the intermediaries, getting to know them, getting to see what they have, making sure they're aware that I exist, because they have been a great source of deal flow. And they, as I think any market, they help by anyone that's gone to them at least has their financials more in order. They've gotten their act together a little bit to prepare for a sale. So it's in some ways faster. The complication is obviously that if it's in a process, it's more expensive. So I've been doing that.
And on the
On the
proprietary.
proprietary, so the proprietary side is the more complicated one. So you have some of these same tools that you have, whether it's, I mean, they all exist, like Grata, SourceScrub, the tools that people use to generate email lists and contact lists that exist in Western markets do kind of exist here. But the problem is that because this is such an inactive market for them, they've all invested very little in data here. And so, for example, I was looking at Apollo and one of the other data solutions. I won't say which one, but one of the other ones, they cost, thousands upon thousands of dollars a year. And I was comparing the data set, and Apollo, which was what, $550 a year for what I needed, had more companies in it than the competitor that was, and it was, less than 10% the price. But it's because nobody has good data. I won't claim Apollo's data was good either. They didn't have, no one had the owner's name or email address or anything, but which speaks to the fact that in general, data here is very spotty on a proprietary basis. And so I think what you end up doing is, you can use Apollo, you can use simple Google searching, have someone off Fiverr help you. You can do a whole, And I think that what you end up doing in reality is you end up triangulating across three, four, or five sources to build out company lists and individual names, and then reach out that way. But the proprietary outreach process, I think, here is a lot more labor intensive and a lot slower than it is in Western markets.
And the ministries don't publish records to the same extent as, you know, other nations. I mean, I'm not even expecting it to be a digital registry in the same way as we have here in the UK. But in terms of like ownership records or that kind of thing, where you can at least get a name, get attached to a license. I mean, are those publicly available?
So what is available, it's a hard database to ping properly. So they do publicly list, and you can ping the every commercial registered license, and see whose email address is on that as their registered person tied to that license. Now, the problem with that is, A, the database is hard to ping. It's not like a company's house where you can kind of search a name and it spits out, you know, pages upon pages of data. It's the database only gives out max 5 results. The license is not necessarily linked to who owns it. In fact, it could just be their admin who went and renewed the license. So there's a disconnect there.
Sponsor, I guess, because that was a local Emirati sponsor. Because my understanding, you used to have to have local representation.
So that is no longer the case now. They changed the law recently.
If you're looking at businesses that were incorporated, you know, 20 years ago.
This database won't tell you who the owner is. It'll just tell you who the the person who registered the license is. So that's the problem with the database, is it doesn't actually link to ownership, but it is there, so you can search. The other problem with that database is it's linked to what is the legal name of the entity. And, you know, legal names can be very different from trade names. And so you need to know what the legal name of the company you're trying to find is. You also need to deal with the fact that a lot of companies here will have multiple entities. And so you might not even be looking for the right entity. You know, it could be, you know, certain companies will have 10 or so entities underneath them, and they might have different registrations, they might have different trade names, and it can get messy. So
free zones.
Exactly.
They often incorporate different subsidiaries to get into different free zones, right?
Exactly. So you're, even though the data is there, it's hard to get the exact data you need. And so the result is, you know, you are often, you know, between I'm using Apollo, LinkedIn Sales Navigator, the government database, and just literally, I have had someone a few times for a sector I like, just go onto Google Maps and search in each part of the country, search for that type of company and see what comes up. And, you know, it's yielding lists but it is labor intensive. I'm actually having a bunch of interns join me this summer, quite literally to push through the manual effort involved in just identifying company names and identifying targets.
Yeah. And then there's the process of actually outreaching and, you know, having conversations with these folks, finding them, to speak to.
This is a separate challenge here as well, which is, you know, in the West, email is very common. Anyone who has ever done business in the Middle East knows that everything here is on WhatsApp, quite literally everything. And, you know, if you're only doing email, you're losing a lot of people that actually might be perfectly willing to respond to you, but just don't check their email. And so, and phone numbers obviously are much more confidential, much harder to get. So it's, even if you know the company, you know the right person, email is quite often not the best way to get them.
Mm. So while we're in the mode of talking about your challenges to your search, I mean, you've mentioned there about the proprietary sourcing and contacting and credit. Do you foresee other challenges? I mean, what's the commercial due diligence going to look like, where, you know, records, financial records might not be as well curated as they are in the West?
I think that'll be a challenge. I think, you know, all the standard challenges that you expect that people have dealt with in the West, I think, will apply. So financial records not being in SMBs, not being up to what you'd need. I think that's a common one everywhere. I think that will be a challenge here. It will be exacerbated a bit here because, though getting better, is in the West, a lot of what drives you to maintain accurate financials is taxes. is you have to file, you have to report to the tax man, and that'll force you to clean things up a little bit. The UAE did not have corporate tax until this year, basically. So you could bet that records pre this year are not in, could be very messy. They have instituted the great price is only 9%. So it's still way less than in the West, but there is now, because of the global rules around corporate taxation, there is now a 9% corporate tax that applies to everyone. So that is forcing a degree of cleanup. Now the difference in the UAE is it's when a rule does come into force, it can be very hard to skirt that rule. The authorities here do take compliance quite seriously. So, it will help cleaning up financials. But I think that's one challenge for sure. I think another challenge that I think is unique to this market is, which relates to the company it's acquired, is the UAE is 90% expat. And what that means though is, there's no local culture. There is, there are 200 cultures or more, there are 500 even, because depending on where the individual is from, but even where that individual is from in their home country. And so if you're looking at a business here, at the SMB size, in many cases, that business is run entirely by people from one nationality or even one region in the country. It could be a Jordanian or Lebanese business that everyone is Lebanese, or in many cases, the biggest business community in the UAE is the South Asian community. And a lot of businesses that will be, everyone will be from Gujarat or Punjab or some region in South Asia. Yeah. And it's Kerala, exactly. And it can be, the challenge there is if you're not from the region, when the business is 100% from, or 80% to 100% from one region, it is virtually impossible to take that business over because culture matters tremendously. So I think that is one nuanced challenge to this market, and that there's no way to solve for it because either you're from that region that the company in question is linked to, or you're not. It's so that part's I think a additional nuanced challenge to hear.
Are you immune to the geopolitical challenges that we're now facing, in Trump 2.0 here in the West? Or we saw today a new spat between India and Bangladesh, India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Are we seeing geopolitical instability in the GCC, or is that relatively protected?
So depends. I think the Middle East is, the Middle East has been perennially unstable for the past 100 years or 150 years. I don't think that will ever change. And it's no secret, we're in a tough neighborhood in the UAE. That being said, I think the impact always varies. We're always exposed to what happens to the price of oil. If it goes down, it doesn't directly, generally the country is liquid enough and wealthy enough that the direct drop in the oil price doesn't hit us too hard directly, but it does directly more negatively impact a few other source markets that are, like Saudi Arabia in particular, that are big for business here. So if the price of oil drops, we do get affected. Conflicts in India and Pakistan can hit us, for example, quite hard because they're massive tourism source markets. So if tourist flows, and in general, Dubai is one of the, I think, top three most visited cities in the world from a tourist standpoint nowadays. So anything that really hits tourism will be an impact here. And then the flip side, I think we were discussing earlier, is because this is a flight to safety market, you always have the countervailing push of when other parts of the world get unstable or start having issues, people tend to come here. They stash their money here. They park their families here because it is, the UAE itself is a very extremely safe, stable market. So it's hard to say. We're not, for example, the UAE, I've gone years without locking my door, and I don't think there's anywhere in the country I'd feel unsafe walking alone at 4 a.m. So that level of safety is just very attractive. I think it's hard to say as a result, what impact the geopolitical instability will have, because there are ways it helps and ways it hurts. But the UAE is in general not a big manufacturer and not a big exporter to the US. So and regardless, Trump only slapped the place with the 10% tariff. So as it affects the UAE directly, Trump tariffs aren't probably going to be that big of an issue.
Awesome. So no more or less volatile than other parts of the world right now.
I'd say, look, we're definitely better off than Europe or East Asia. That's for sure.
Yeah, great. Okay, so let's fast forward 12 months. What do you want to have achieved at Oryx Legacy by then?
I mean, look, I'd love to be in the CEO position of a company and Oryx Legacy, the search kind of be closed. Realistically, I think that's probably a bit over-optimistic. Deal timelines in the Middle East do take, I think, a lot longer than in other markets. You know, things can be slower here than elsewhere. Realistically, what I've told myself is I need to have found, if this is going to work, I need to have at least found the company that I'm going to close on by the end of the first year. I don't need to be closed on it or, very actively in discussions, but I need to have found it, because I do think I need to give myself a year to go through the diligence process, negotiation process, et cetera, because it's going to be, things just take a while in the Middle East. So I'd love to be, my target is to be in active negotiations with someone by the end of the first year.
Awesome.
People.
That is the case. And we'd love to have you back to tell us how it went once you've got one over the line. Do you have any particular takeaways or messages that you'd like listeners of the M&A Zing to grasp?
I feel, look, think about, for a lot of people, a lot of people tend to ignore the search in emerging markets is not as big of a thing just yet. I think one thing I'd flag is do consider it. Do look at these other markets. I think it's certainly viable. I think the trends that underpinned why search has worked so well in the US, UK, Spain, et cetera, do apply in emerging markets, maybe with a slight twist, but the fundamental trends still apply. And so I think one thing I would say is don't, if you're thinking about it in an emerging market, don't think just because no one's done it before that it can't work. And you might find that the receptiveness to the concept is, in fact, quite high. People have been, the joke is, which I've talked to people about this as well, is whereas if you cold outreach to someone in the West, you might get 1%, 1.5% of people responding. Here, the response rate's closer to 10 to 20%. So it can very well work.
Wow, that's two inspiring takeaways there. Response rate, for one, piqued my interest, but also your example that just because it hasn't been done doesn't mean that the conditions aren't right for it to be done. That's a great takeaway. Thanks so much for that, Adam. So how might a listener get in contact with you if they wanted to tap your brain on this space?
If they want to learn more about what I'm doing precisely, oryxlegacy.com is the website, and anyone can reach out to me directly, adam@oryxlegacy.com. So just drop me an email and I'm very active.
Fabulous. Thanks so much, Adam. It's been really inspiring listening today to your journey and hearing about your thesis. I really think it's a pioneer in what you're doing in the UAE, sort of championing the search fund scene, and we're delighted to hear the progress that you've made, and love to loop back and hear how it's gone in 12 months time. You're building in such a vibrant region, I'm absolutely amazed to hear of so much opportunity. I'm sure some of our listeners are as well. So folks, check the show notes for links to connect with Adam and learn a little bit more about Oryx Legacy. Meanwhile, join me in saying thanks, Adam, and to everybody out there, keep on crunching. Until next time, thanks.
Thanks for having me.